coming to Pittsburgh. Tell me a little bit about your family when you were growing up. You mentioned that your father was a socialist in the old country. Did that carry over into his religious opinions? Was there, did you have a Jewish home life? What was the Jewish aspect of your home life?
Yes. There was only 60 Jewish families, as I said, and most of them were kind of ignorant kind of orthodoxy. They weren't nearly as learned as my father. And he laughed at a lot of their procedures. They had some very good rabbis from, I guess, even before I was born. But they either died or left. So, what could 60 families pay? So my father sent us to the next town, which was in East St. Louis, so-called conservative congregation. I remember waiting for the streetcar on Sunday morning to go to Sunday school. I was 4 years old. And then we got tired of that. And what happened? I can't remember. That we had various texts which we had to, for a while, that we didn't go to any Sunday school. And my father didn't like the people running the congregation in Belleville. So he just sort of taught us, and eventually, of course, my brothers went to Cheder with the other rabbi. But I don't even know whether there was a rabbi in town at a certain period. And the new rabbi came and they reorganized the congregation, and my father rejoined and took prominent leadership. I was then sent to Cheder. But he was always having fights, and every 2 years at least there was a new rabbi. So eventually we went, joined a Reformed congregation in St. Louis, and I finished Sunday school there. And my older brother Gene was confirmed in the congregation in East St. Louis, and my brother Norman was confirmed in the congregation of St. Louis, and his wife was a member of that confirmation class. I think she's past president of Temple Sisterhood National and all that stuff. He's long past president of the congregation, still very active. My father, once my folks moved to St. Louis, my father became active. Of course, it was a different kind of congregation, and he couldn't take the kind of leadership as the lawyers and doctors and all the university people. He was very modest about his lack of formal education. And I was by then so much into music that I wandered off and just have done my own religious life. I belong to Temple Sinai and attend as regularly as I can.
When was it that you came to Pittsburgh?
1947.
What was Pittsburgh like then?
It was still pretty dirty, but already people were saying, "Oh, it's better this year than it was," especially during the war. And they were just tearing down the old stuff at the point. I remember shopping at the Diamond Market, which was still in existence then, Market Square. And everything, of course, was trolley. watched me very slow. There was the, what was it called? On the corner of Ellsworth and Fifth, where they had hockey games and things like that. That old stuff, I remember. And I played in a chamber music group which gave concerts at the auditorium on Center Avenue, Jewish Community Center, which is still one of the best auditoriums in the city, I think. Even played in with a string quartet, of which Lauren Mazel was the first violinist.
Huh. What auditorium is that?
I guess it's Emma Kaufman Auditorium on the hill. And with the new center that's been built, it's been built all around it. That's been preserved within the new center. I don't know what it's used for now. It was wonderful. We'd be busy playing, you know, rehearse for a week. We'd be busy playing, and the folks would come down in the front and read the paper. And then when you finish, you got up and left. And it was a warm place to read the paper.
Where did you live when you first came here?
I rented a room on Solway Street. And then my friend, the harpist from St. Louis, became first harp here, and the fellow from Atlantic City, who was bass clarinet, and I got an apartment on the second floor of a house on Aylesboro and Shady. And we lived there for 3 years and moved for 1 year to Shadyside. And they went on to the Detroit Symphony, and I stayed here. After 3 years down here on Darlington, 3 or 4 years, I found this house. My folks liked it. When I first moved, the next day the Pittsburgh Symphony left for a 6 weeks tour, and my father and mother stayed here all that time. In fact, much longer, repairing and fixing, you know. And it doesn't look like. But now the music and books have overcome me. I was planning to go visit my niece and nephew in San Francisco, but I decided I'll stay home and put things away.
Am busy. What was the musical life like in Pittsburgh? It sounds like there was a lot going on even in 1947. What was going on there?
Well, the Pittsburgh Symphony had a 28-week season, of which I think 18 weeks were subscription concerts at Syria Mosque, conducted by Fritz Reiner. And then there were concerts in the high schools. We would travel around to the high schools, conducted by Vladimir Bakalenikov. Mm-hmm. We had no summer season, and no unemployment compensation in the summer. And the next year, they had to cut back even further because there was such a big deficit. Mm-hmm. But the YMHA series was already in existence, and there was at that time the series, which is now called Pittsburgh Chamber Music Society, was then called the New Friends of Music, which was sparked by Dr. and Mrs. Norton. Eunice Norton and her husband, Dr. Eunice Norton is a very fine pianist and performed and brought all kinds of the Budapest String Quartet. The music in synagogues was not nearly as good as it is now, so far as I know. I guess there was just Rhoda Fulham at that time. I don't know if there were other Reformed congregations yet.
Were you involved at all with the Jewish community at the time?
Well, as a matter of fact, I had a letter of introduction from our rabbi in St. Louis to Dr. Freehoff. They had been classmates at UHC, and I was very well received by Dr. Freehoff, and I joined the junior congregation. I went to a couple of events, and I could just as well have been a part of the paint on the wall, you know, because if you didn't go at least to Alderdice or to whatever private school there were at that time, you didn't count in that snobbish atmosphere there. I don't think it's quite that way now. But in any case, I was not the kind to elbow my way into what I felt was a close group of people. Mm-hmm. And certainly as a Pittsburgh Symphony musician working about one half the year, I couldn't keep up with the others, with the kinds of expenditure and way of life.
What did you do the other half of the year?
After my first year, I went back to Juilliard to do more of the academic work and continue my studies with of Bach interpretation with the man with whom I started when I was living in New York. And then the next year, in February or March, I read in the Sunday Times that since it was 1950, there would be, in the small town where Pablo Casals had exiled himself, a series of concerts of the works of Johann Sebastian Bach. Now, the man with whom I was studying Bach interpretation was a close friend of Casals, and who was the actual teacher of the so-called Casals class at the École Normale in Paris before the war. And I had met Alexander Schneider, who was also studying with the same man. I had met him at the end of one of Sasha's lessons, so I quickly sent a telegram, pupil of Viren Alexanian, first lutenist of Pittsburgh Symphony, I would like to join the festival. So that's how I... After my second year in the Pittsburgh Symphony, I went to Paris to study. And it was the following year, actually, the summer of 1950, that I went to France to play with Casals. And after the Casals Festival was over, then I went back to Paris. Of course, my father's cousins were there. They took me in as a member of the family. You know, so many of the family had been lost. I guess there was something like 37, something like that, 35, 40 Goldbergs in Paris before the war. And about 12, 13 after the war. So began a very long association with Casals. Perpetual source of inspiration for me, even though he's long gone.
What kind of relationship? Want to elaborate on it? In what way?
Well, we became friends. He was so warm to everybody that everybody could count him as a friend. Mm-hmm. And eventually I would go back after the festival to spend as much time as I could, and I took lessons from him, and would go to his house and have discussions and things like that. He was always very encouraging and very emphatic about the need for great music as a way of trying to create an attitude for peace. It's a pity that he couldn't live just a little bit longer to survive Franco. That was his ambition, but Generalissimo Franco was his personal enemy. I should say fascism.
What other musicians were in that group of people?
OOY was a very wonderful group of people led by Alexander Schneider, who had been second violin in the Budapest Quartet when they were at the height of their career as a quartet, and his brother Misha, who just had played cello. No, excuse me, in France it was Paul Tortelier, who was principal cello, and you know, Rudolf Serkin was closely involved, and Joseph Zigeti in the first years, and Isaac Stern, Eugene Istomin, and many orchestra players from the best orchestras in Europe and in America. John Woomer, the New York Philharmonic, was the first flutist. I played second. And at times they had some of the greatest clarinetists of France, other times people from here. The greatest oboist of the world, probably, Marcel Capitaux from Philadelphia and France was there. And it was, especially the first year, all our devotion was to this man who stopped his career in protest against the continuance of the relationship between the Western democracies and the surviving fascist regime in Spain, Franco. So as the violinist B. Dassin, who at that time was the wife of Jules Dassin, the movie maker, said in a speech at a party, "Your exile has ended." She said to Casals, "You won't go to the world, but the world has come to you." To learn, you know, how we can dedicate our lives, our art, to peace.
Do you feel that you, the group, did you share in his sentiments? Was this a political statement that you were making as well as a musical one there?
For some of us, not for all, we were convinced that there were some CIA people that were keeping track of things, but it was maybe wishful thinking. for some, not for all. For many, it was, I think, a purely musical thing, and for many, it was also purely a career thing. You know, to be associated with that legend.
How many years did you do this?
Well, there was money for us to be brought over, 50, 51, 52, 53. Then in 1957, they started the Casals Festival in Puerto Rico. And I did most of them until his death. And then the last one, 1976, before they changed the format, when they had an orchestra for the anniversary of the 100th anniversary of his birth. So I got a lot of music making with him. And then of course when Steinberg came, there was so much more of the same. After all, he founded the Israeli, he was one of the founders of the Israel Philharmonic, and a man of great idealism. Endless stories about him.
Awesome.
Well, you know, he was such a great conductor at an early age. He was already the general director and music director of the Frankfurt Opera when the Nuremberg laws were enacted in Germany. So he had to organize and conduct an orchestra of Jewish musicians who would not be allowed to play in other places, in orchestras, and were only allowed to play in synagogues and Jewish community centers and things like that. And finally left, and with Huberman helped found what's now the Israeli Philharmonic, and lived there for a while, and then came to this country at the invitation of Toscanini. And then was out of work for a long time. Because, I guess, he was a refugee and he didn't have his connections, you know. This conducting is the most political part of the music business there is, actually. Who you know and who can you can have help manipulate the musical scene to get work. And eventually you can do what you can do. But so much of his music making, after all, was in the grand tradition of European idealistic art, humanistic approach to the art. But we need to understand what these great minds had to say and communicate them, not just stand up there and make pretty sounds and get paid more and more for subjects for PR articles. Unfortunately, I think the Pittsburgh Symphony suffered because of his idealism and his lack of interest in PR.
When did he come?
Steinberg came in 1952. And then we began recording and making big tours. 1964, we made an 11-week tour of Europe and the Middle East by the State Department. We had to play in near Beirut, Beirut, in Lebanon, on the site of a temple built by the Romans, which I understand has now been destroyed by the fighting between one set of Arabs and another. And we played in, the State Department insisted that we play in Tehran so we couldn't lose Iran. But since we played there, I mean, in order to play there, we were not allowed, we couldn't play in Israel, which broke Steinberg's heart, and he fought like a tiger to have us play in Israel. But the Arab countries wouldn't accept us if we played in Israel. And for the State Department, it was more important that we could save those countries to be America's allies. But it was a very moving experience to play in Poland. For many of us, either our parents or grandparents, actually came from there. A group went to visit Treblinka or Auschwitz, and one of our bass players saw in the display of the luggage and satchels that were put right there the name of a relative.
Oh,
can you imagine how hard?
Mm-hmm. How was PR handled while Steinberg was here? How was the orchestra structured?
Well, I really don't know, since it's not my business to understand what happens in the offices.
Mm-hmm.
I just know that it's never been, I don't think that the PR has ever been as good as the music making. You know, we've just come back from Massachusetts,
mm-hmm.
where we opened that new music festival up there.
Mm-hmm.
And the audiences, of course, up there, the audiences are much more demonstrative than here. And the Boston Pops, and they go to the Charles River, and, you know, they're to less than the most serious classical concerts, it's a big holiday. But screaming and yelling, and my gosh, Michael Tilson Thomas was conducting, had to take the concertmaster by the arm and pull us off stage.
Mm-hmm.
The same thing was happening in our recent tours in Europe, especially the last one with Lauren Mazel. All those Waldheim supporters at the Salzburg Festival in their evening gowns, and you know, were jumping up and down at our music making.
I take it the same thing does not happen here.
No, here there's a big contest to get to the parking lot first. When the audience stands, it's usually to run.
Has it always been that way in Pittsburgh?
Not so much at Syrian Mosque, because in those days parking was easier. Thank gosh we're out of there now, because now you can't find any place to park in Oakland. You know? Nobody can park in Oakland. When I was, I guess, performer in residence or something like that at the University of Pittsburgh, every time I had to have a committee meeting with members of the faculty about the forthcoming programs, I always got parking tickets, you know. Mm-hmm. They talk too much and the parking meter goes too fast. So I've been living in this house since 1959, and it's a very nice house. I don't know if it's quite big enough for all my music and books, but I look forward sometime to retirement when I can start to get through more of them than I do. And I also go one day a week to Brooklyn College, where I'm a member of the faculty there. And that's a very interesting experience. You know, for me, from a small town where, certainly in grade school, I was the only Jewish person. In high school, there were maybe two or three at a time. To be in Brooklyn College is such a heartwarming experience. I had one pupil who just graduated. If her lesson happened to be towards sundown, she would stop and go in the corner to daven. You know, the lesson stopped. All right, I didn't, but but you know, there's a special cafeteria there, a kosher cafeteria, which joins onto a little garden, which is made then into a sukkah. And it really makes me feel terrific to be there and have good students, all foreign. She was the only American student that I have there, from Phoenix, Arizona.
What is her name, if I may ask?
Michelle Beck.
How did you get a connection to Brooklyn College?
Well, every summer I've been giving seminars, either in central Pennsylvania at Mount Gretna, where I used to play in a chamber music series, which was especially convenient for me when the Pittsburgh Symphony played in Ambler by Philadelphia in the summer. And some people came to me who were students of Brooklyn College and said, why don't you come teach there? What do you mean? You think I could? I'll talk to the head of the department. So I was in New York visiting. I called her up, the head of the department, Dr. Klotzman. And, excuse me, so you want to teach? Okay. So little by little, my class has grown to the point that I have the maximum allowable as an adjunct professor. It's a long to teach 9 hours in one day and then come home.
A long day.
It's a long day, and I have a sort of waiting list of private pupils. But you know, everything in its time.
I think that we are just about run out. If okay. My watch is right. Might want to stop for today. Am I right?
I can't tell.
Okay.
If it is,
maybe so. It's 8:84,
yes.
So it must be. Okay.
I don't know whether it was the Philharmonic or the government, I can't remember. In late years, gave Steinberg a piece of rock I think maybe, I can't imagine it would be from the Western Wall, but from some biblical remains, and all polished up and mounted. And I was in his office at the Heinz Hall, and he said to me, "You see that? After all these years, they give this to me. What am I supposed to do? Wear it around my neck?" Drown me with it. But you know that after he died, he had himself cremated, and his ashes scattered on the Sea of Galilee.
Oh, my. He was that...
Does that thunder?
I hope not. We're supposed to go to the ball game tonight.
Oh. It might help the pirates.